A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. The second half of Chapter 2, The Prevailing Opinion About Sexual Differences. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Now think about women who are restrained by principle or prejudice. They would shrink from an intrigue with real abhorrence, but play with the idea because they want to be convinced by the homage of gallantry that they are cruelly neglected by their husbands, or they spend days and weeks dreaming of the happiness enjoyed by souls in harmony, until their health is undermined and their spirits broken by discontent. If that is right, then how can it have been so necessary for them to study the great art of pleasing? It is useful only to a mistress. The chaste wife and serious mother should regard her power to please as merely the polish of her virtues, and the affection of her husband as merely one of the comforts that make her task less difficult and her life happier. But whether she is loved or neglected, her first wish should be to make herself worthy of respect, and not rely for all her happiness on a being who is subject to infirmities like her own. The amiable Dr. Gregory fell into a similar error. I respect his heart, but entirely disapprove of his celebrated A Father's Legacy to His Daughters. He advises them to develop a fondness for dress, because this, he says, is natural to them. I can't understand what he or Rousseau mean in their frequent uses of the vague word natural. If they told us that the soul before birth was fond of dress, and brought this inclination with it into a new body, I would listen to them with a half-smile, as I often do when I hear someone pontificating about innate elegance. But if Gregory meant to say only that using one's faculties will give one this fondness for dress, I deny it. It is not natural. It arises like false ambition in men from a love of power. Dr. Gregory goes much further. He actually recommends dissimulation, and advises an innocent girl to give the lie to her feelings and not dance with spirit, when gaiety of heart would make her feet eloquent, without making her gestures immodest. In the name of truth and common sense, why should not one woman acknowledge that she can take more exercise than another? Or in other words, that she has a sound constitution? And why, to damp innocent vivacity, is she to be told that men will draw conclusions which she little thinks of? Let the libertine draw what inference he pleases, but I hope that no sensible mother will restrain the natural frankness of youth by instilling such indecent cautions. Women ought to try to purify their hearts, but can they do so when their undeveloped understandings make them entirely dependent on their senses for occupation and amusement, when no noble undertaking raises them above the day's little vanities, or enables them to curb the wild emotions that agitate a reed over which every passing breeze has power? To gain the affections of a virtuous man, is affectation necessary? Nature has given woman a weaker body than man, but to ensure her husband's affections, must a wife lower herself to pretend to be sickly and delicate in order to secure her husband's affection? It very often really is pretending on the part of a wife who, by the exercise of her mind and body, while she was discharging the duties of a daughter, wife, and mother, has allowed her constitution to retain its natural strength, and her nerves a healthy tone. Weakness may excite tenderness, and gratify the arrogant pride of man, but the lordly caresses of a protector won't please a noble mind that is panting for respect and deserves to have it. Fondness is a poor substitute for friendship. Besides, the woman who strengthens her body and exercises her mind will, by managing her family and practicing various virtues, become the friend, and not the humble dependent, of her husband. And if she deserves his respect by having such solid qualities, she won't find that she needs to conceal her affection, or pretend to an unnatural coldness of constitution to excite her husband's passions. Look at history, and you'll find that the women who have distinguished themselves haven't been the most beautiful or the most gentle of their sex. Nature, or, to speak more accurately, God, has made all things right. But man has devised many inventions to spoil God's work. I am referring to the part of Dr. Gregory's book where he advises a wife never to let her husband know the extent of her sensibility or affection. That is as ineffectual as it is absurd. By its very nature, love must be transitory. Searching for a secret that would make it constant is as wild as searching for the philosopher's stone that can turn lead into gold, or the grand panacea that can cure every disease. And if the search succeeded, and something was discovered that would make love constant, that would be useless, or rather pernicious, to mankind. The most holy tie of society is friendship. The shrewd satirist La Rochefoucauld was right when he said that, rare as true love is, true friendship is still rarer. This is an obvious truth, and the reason for it is easy to find, because it doesn't lie deep. Love, the common passion, in which chance replaces choice and sensation replaces reason, is felt to some degree by everyone. I am not talking here about emotions that rise above love, or ones that sink below it. This passion, naturally increased by suspense and difficulties, draws the mind out of its usual state and exalts the affections. But the fever of love is allowed to subside by the security of marriage. It's released from the kinds of suspense and difficulties that occur in a love affair. The only people who find a healthy temperature insipid are ones who don't have enough intellect to substitute the calm tenderness of friendship for blind admiration, and the confidence of respect for the emotions of foolish sensuality. This is the course of nature. It has to be. Love is inevitably followed by either friendship or indifference. And this state of affairs seems to harmonize perfectly with the how things go generally in the moral world. Passions are spurs to action and open the mind, but when the object has been gained and the satisfied mind relaxes in enjoyment, the passions sink to the level of mere appetites, a matter of momentary personal gratification. The man who had some virtue while he was struggling for a crown often becomes a voluptuous tyrant when he is wearing it, and when the lover continues to exist in the husband, the result is a foolish old man who is prey to childish whims and foolish jealousies, and neglects the serious duties of life, and by whom the caresses that should arouse confidence in his children are lavished on the overgrown child, his wife. In order to fulfil the duties of life, and to be able to pursue with vigour the various employments that form the moral character, a master and mistress of a family ought not to continue to love each other with passion. I mean that they ought not to indulge emotions that disturb the order of society, and engross the thoughts that should be otherwise employed. A mind that has never been absorbed by one object lacks vigour. A mind that can be thus obsessed for a long time is downright weak. I haven't the faintest thought of producing a paradox when I say an unhappy marriage is often very advantageous to a family, and a neglected wife is in general the best mother. This would almost always be the case if the female mind were more enlarged. Let me explain why. God's plans seem to have ruled that, in most cases, what we gain in present enjoyment is to be deducted from our experience, which is the true treasure of life, and that when we are gathering the flowers of the day and revelling in pleasure, the solid fruit of toil and wisdom is not to be caught at the same time. The road forks here. We must go to the right or to the left, and someone who spends his life bounding from one pleasure to another mustn't complain if he acquires neither wisdom nor a character worthy of respect. Supposing for a moment that the soul is not immortal, and that man was only created for the present scene, I think we would have reason to complain that love, infantine fondness, became increasingly insipid and palled upon the senses. Let us eat, drink, and love, for tomorrow we die, would be in fact the language of reason, the morality of life. And who but a fool would part with the reality for a fleeting shadow? But if, awed by observing the improvable powers of the mind, we disdain to confine our wishes or thoughts to such a comparatively narrow field of action, which appears grand and important only through its being connected with a boundless prospect and sublime hopes, what necessity is there for falsehood in conduct? And why must the sacred majesty of truth be violated to detain a deceitful good that saps the very foundation of virtue? Why must the female mind be tainted by coquettish arts to gratify the sensualist, and prevent love from subsiding into friendship or compassionate tenderness, when there are no qualities on which friendship can be built? Let the honest heart show itself, and reason teach passion to submit to necessity. I'm not talking about the romantic passion that is the concomitant of genius. Who can clip its wings? But that grand passion is out of proportion to the little enjoyments of life. What it is true to is only itself. What it feeds on is only itself. The passions that have been celebrated for their durability have always been unfortunate. They have been strengthened by absence and by constitutional melancholy. The imagination has hovered round a dimly seen form of beauty. Familiarity with it might have turned admiration into disgust, or at least into indifference, and freed the imagination to start fresh game. According to this view of things, it is perfectly proper for Rousseau to make the heroine of his novel, Julie, love her tutor when life was fading before her. But this is no proof of the immortality of the passion. Of the same sort is Gregory's advice regarding delicacy of sentiment. He advises a woman not to acquire sentiment if she intends to marry. This intention is perfectly consistent with his former advice, but here he calls sentiment indelicate, and earnestly persuades his daughters to conceal it, even if it governs their conduct, as if it were indelicate to have the common appetites of human nature. Noble morality, and consistent with the cautious prudence of a little soul that can't look further than the present tiny fraction of our existence. If all the faculties of woman's mind are to be cultivated only with respect to her dependence on man, if when she gets a husband she has reached her goal and is satisfied with such a trivial crown, let her contentedly grovel in the dirt, scarcely raised by her employments above the lower animals. But if she is struggling for the prize of her high calling, let her look beyond the present scene. Let her develop her understanding without stopping to consider what the husband she is going to marry will be like. If she resolves to acquire the qualities that a noble, rational being, without being too anxious about present happiness, a rough, inelegant husband may shock her taste, but he won't destroy her peace of mind. She will model her soul not to make it fit with her companion's frailties, but to enable it to put up with them. His character may be a trial, but it won't be an impediment to virtue. If Gregory meant to be talking only about romantic expectations of constant love and congenial feelings, he should have remembered that such expectations exist only when the imagination is kept alive at the expense of reason, that advice can never make them go away, but that experience can do so. I admit that many women who have developed in themselves a romantic, unnatural delicacy of feeling have wasted their lives in imagining how happy they would have been with a husband who could love them with intense and increasing affection all day, every day. But they might as well lament married as lament single. They wouldn't be a jot more unhappy with a bad husband than they are longing for a good one. I agree that a proper education, or more accurately, a well-stocked mind, would enable a woman to live unmarried with dignity. But what if she avoids cultivating her taste in case her future husband, if she comes to have one, should occasionally shock it? That is quitting a substance for a shadow. The fact is that I don't know what use an improved taste is, if it's not to make the individual more independent of life's disasters, and to open up new sources of enjoyment that depend only on the solitary operations of the mind. People of taste, whether married or single it makes no difference, will always be disgusted by various things that have no effect on less observant minds. But that fact on its own mustn't be allowed to disqualify taste. The question is, in the whole sum of enjoyment, is taste to be counted as a blessing? Does taste procure more pain or more pleasure? The answer will settle whether Gregory's advice was good, and will show how absurd and tyrannical it is to lay down a system of slavery as he does, or to try to educate moral beings by any rules other than those deduced from pure reason, which apply to the whole species. Gentleness of manners, forbearance, and long-suffering are such lovable godlike qualities that high-flying poetry has attributed them to God, and there may be no representation of his goodness that fastens on the human affections as strongly as those that represent him abundant in mercy and willing to pardon. Looked at this point of view, gentleness has all the marks of grandeur, combined with the winning graces of kindness towards subordinates. But how different gentleness looks when it is the submissive manner of a dependent, the support of weakness that loves because it needs protection, and is forbearing because it must silently endure injuries, smiling under the lash at which it doesn't dare to snarl. This picture of degradation is the portrait of an accomplished woman. According to the received opinion of female excellence as something different from human excellence. Or they, for example Rousseau and Swedenborg, kindly give Adam back his rib, making one moral being of a man and woman, and not forgetting to give her all the submissive charms. We aren't told how women are to exist in a state of affairs where there is no marriage. Moralists have agreed that the tenor of life seems to prove that man is prepared by various circumstances for a future state, but they are unanimous in advising woman to provide only for the present. Gentleness, docility, and spaniel-like affection are consistently recommended as the cardinal virtues of the sex, and one writer has declared that it is masculine for a woman to be sad. She was created to be the man's toy, his rattle, and it must jingle in his ears whenever he dismisses reason and chooses to be amused. It is absolutely correct to recommend gentleness in a general way. A frail being, and all humans are frail, should try to be gentle. But when forbearance confuses right with wrong, it stops being a virtue. It may be found agreeable in a companion, but that companion will always be regarded as an inferior, and will inspire only a flat and lifeless tenderness which easily degenerates into contempt. Still, if advice really could make gentle a being to whom such a fine polish isn't natural, that would move things on a little in the direction of true morality. But it's easy to show that what such advice actually produces is affectation, pretense, which puts a stumbling block in the way of personal improvement, so that the female sex gets little benefit from sacrificing solid virtues to the acquiring of superficial graces, even if for a few years these graces give the individual a great deal of power. As a philosopher, I read with indignation the nice-sounding descriptions that men use to soften their insults, and as a moralist, I ask what they mean by such oxymorons as fair defects, amiable weaknesses, and so on. If there is only one criterion of morals for men, only one model for them to follow, women seem to be suspended by destiny. They don't have the unerring instinct of the lower animals, but nor are they allowed to fix the eye of reason on a perfect model. They were made to be loved, and must not aim at respect, lest they should be hunted out of society as masculine. Look at this topic now from a different angle. Do passive, idle women make the best wives? Never mind the afterlife just now. Let us confine our discussion to the present moment of existence, and ask, how well do such weak creatures perform their part? Do the women who have attained a few superficial accomplishments contribute only to the happiness of their husbands? Do they display their charms merely to entertain them? And do women who are brought up on notions of passive obedience have enough character to manage a family or educate children? So far from it, that after surveying the history of woman, I can't help agreeing with the severest satirist who regards the female sex as the weaker, as well as the more oppressed half of the species. What does history reveal except marks of inferiority? How many women have freed themselves from the humiliating yoke of sovereign man? So few that the exceptions remind me of the ingenious conjecture that Newton was probably a being of a superior order, accidentally caged in a human body. Following that line of thought, I have been led to imagine that the few extraordinary women who have rushed in various directions out of the orbit prescribed to their sex were male spirits, confined by mistake in a female body. But if it isn't philosophical to think of sex when the soul is mentioned, the inferiority of women must depend on the organs, or else the heavenly fire that makes the clay develop isn't distributed in equal portions. I'm continuing to avoid any direct comparison between the two sexes collectively. I do frankly acknowledge the inferiority of woman according to the present appearance of things, and I insist that men have increased that inferiority until women are almost sunk below the standard of rational creatures. Let their faculties have room to unfold, and their virtues to gain strength, and then determine where the whole sex must stand in the intellectual scale. But don't forget that for a small number of distinguished women, I do not ask for a place. It's hard for us dim-sighted mortals to say what height human discoveries and improvements may arrive at when we are freed from the gloom of despotism that makes us stumble at every step. But there's one prediction I'm willing to make without being gifted with a prophetic spirit. It is that when morality is settled on a more solid basis, woman will be either man's friend or his slave. There will be no question, as there is now, as to whether she is a moral agent, or rather the link that unites man with the lower animals. And if it does then turn out that, like the lower animals, women were principally created for the use of man, he will let them patiently bite the bridle and not mock them with empty praise. And if, on the other hand, their rationality comes to be proved, man won't impede their improvement merely to gratify his sensual appetites. He won't use all the graces of rhetoric to persuade them to submit their understandings uncritically to the guidance of man. He won't, when discussing the education of women, assert that they ought never to have the free use of reason. Surely there can be only one rule of right, if morality has an eternal foundation. And whoever sacrifices virtue, strictly so called, to present convenience, lives only for the passing day, and can't be a morally responsible creature. If that is the category into which women belong, then the poet Matthew Prior should have dropped his sneer when he wrote, "If weak women go astray, the stars are more in fault than they." Why? Because if women are like that, then what he says about them is simply true, and not a fit topic for sneering sarcasm. If it comes to be proved that women will never exercise their own reason, be independent, rise above opinion, feel the dignity of a rational will that bows only to God, and often forgets that the universe contains any being but itself and God, then quite certainly they are bound by the unbreakable chain of destiny. I am proceeding by argument. I am not willing to impress by rhetoric when reason offers her sober light. If women are really capable of acting like rational creatures, let them not be treated like slaves, or like lower animals who depend on the reason of man when they associate with him. Instead, develop their minds, give them the salutary, sublime curb of principle, and let them attain conscious dignity by feeling that they depend only on God. Teach them, in common with man, to submit to necessity, instead of trying to make them more pleasing by giving a sex to morals. And if it turns out that they can't reach the same degree of strength of mind, perseverance, and fortitude as men can, let their virtues be the same in kind as men's, although they can't be the same in degree. And man's superiority will be equally clear, if not clearer, and truth would be common to both. This wouldn't invert the order of society as it is now, because woman would then have only the rank that reason assigned to her, and she couldn't employ her skills to level the balance, let alone to make it swing the other way. These may be called utopian dreams, but I shan't be deterred by that. I give thanks to the being who impressed them on my soul, and gave me enough strength of mind to dare to employ my own reason, until, becoming dependent only on him for the support of my virtue, I view with indignation the mistaken notions that enslave my sex. I love man as my fellow, but his sceptre doesn't reign over me, unless I owe homage to the reason of an individual. And even if I do, what I am submitting to is reason, not to man. In fact, the behaviour of a morally accountable being must be regulated by the operations of his or her own reason. If that is wrong, what foundation does the throne of God rest on? It seems to me that I have to dwell on these obvious truths because females have been insulted, as it were, stripped of the virtues that should clothe humanity. They have been decked out with artificial graces that enable them to be tyrants for a little time, because in them love takes the place of every nobler passion. Their sole ambition is to be beautiful, to raise emotion instead of inspiring respect, and this ignoble desire, like the servility in absolute monarchies, destroys all strength of character. Liberty is the mother of virtue, and if women are slaves by their very constitution, and not allowed to breathe the sharp, invigorating air of freedom, they must always languish like exotics, and be regarded as beautiful flaws in nature. The argument about the subjection in which the sex has always been held can be turned back on man. The many have always been subject to the few, and monsters who have shown almost no perception of human excellence have tyrannized over thousands of their fellow creatures. Why have men with superior gifts submitted to such degradation? Doesn't everyone know that kings, taken as a whole, have always been inferior in abilities and virtue to the same number of men taken from the common mass of mankind? Yet haven't they been, and aren't they still, treated with a degree of reverence that is an insult to reason? China isn't the only country where a living man has been made a god. Men have submitted to superior strength so as to enjoy with impunity the pleasure of the moment, and women have only done the same. Therefore, until it is proved that the courtier, who servilely gives up his birthright as a man, is not a moral agent, it can't be argued that woman is essentially inferior to man because she has always been subjugated. End of chapter 2.